All right, it is Monday morning, July 20th, 10:20, Chem 3. And what I wanted to say, announcement-wise, this morning, is that I have a new homework assignment up for Chapter 7, and that we are in our last week of class, which is both exciting and terrifying. So this week is going to go by very quickly. And there we go. And with this week going by so quickly, I have great concerns about keeping everybody on track. And I haven't done all the assessment that I wanted to do. Normally I do two tests and a final. This time it looks like I'm only doing the one test and the final. And that I want to get another quiz or two in if we can, in order to make it a little bit easier. And I'm going to reduce down the number of points that are on that final so that it's less points compared to the overall class. So it's not as much percentage on a final exam. And I'm just going to try to soften the blow and make it a little bit easier as we're going through all of this. So that's kind of what my goal is. But also I'm concerned a lot about those people that are following asynchronously. And so they're not here and they can't ask anything in the chat or online while we're going through, but I want to speak to those people who are attending asynchronously, particularly that my grades for this class are due, I believe, on Monday or Tuesday. Cabrillo has a very quick turnaround for grades, which means that when I put that final up on Thursday, that you guys are going to have to sort of attack that final and try and get that final done over the weekend, that you can't sort of slack or wait to complete anything here. Same thing for any assignments that are outstanding assignments that you're going to need to really work diligently this week and be on top of things. So this is just a plea for you guys to sort of be on top of it this week and to think about other commitments that you have this week and trying to clear the boards a little bit and really finishing out all the work that we need to do for this class so that all of that gets in so that I can get those grades in Monday or Tuesday. And what to expect for the length of the final. I usually make the final about 1.5 times the length of a midterm. So based on the length of the midterm that you took last time, you can expect it to be about half again as long. Part of it being sort of cumulative, part of it being the new material. And will we get two attempts on the final? Yeah, I think so. But also with that time constraint, thinking about that time constraint, that we're gonna have a little bit more time constraint this week just because of how I have to get the grades in and Cabrillo's time deadlines with me in terms of the way that the grades get communicated. So I wanted to be upfront with that and try to keep us all on track. So what I'm doing with that is I'm using Lab to use as problem-solving sessions to try to do homework together and do assignments together in order to complete and finish out everything that I'm asking you guys to do. So we can expect to keep rolling that through Lab and seeing using our time that way for those people. And anybody who wants to come and join the Lab session, you are all welcome to join either the morning or the afternoon Lab session, or if you want to go to both, you're welcome in both. You don't have to stay in just one. And if you don't attend Lab and you'd like to work and use those as a study session as well, even if you are not enrolled in Lab, you are more than welcome to attend. Just email me for a link and I'll put a link up there for you. You can tell me which lab you'd like to attend and I will give you a link so that you can jump in and follow it. So that's available for you too as well. I have three things that I want to accomplish this week in terms of content material. I want to look at gas loss, which we're going to do today. I want to look at phase changes for materials and the energy associated with phase changes. So how do we go from solids to liquids, liquids to gases, those types of phase changes and energy associated with them. And the last thing that I want to do is acid base and equilibrium, which are kind of tied together. And those are generally the last topic that we cover in this class anyway. So those three topics we've got to cover in this week. And that's what we're going to attempt to do. So today, I'm going to attempt to do everything that I can for gas laws and try to fit that in, which normally it does. Gas laws cover a little bit easier. We can fit in almost entirely within one lecture. So let's pick that up and let's start with the gas laws and look at what we need to do. With gas laws, let's see if I've got this in memory. It's supposed to be in memory, which it's not. Unfortunate. Well, we'll do it this way. This is chapter 8 that we're starting. And with the gas laws, I want to grab an instrument. Actually, I'm just going to grab this piece. Oh, I know what's going on. I couldn't figure out why I was hearing music slightly playing in the background. It's because music was slightly playing in the background. All right, that's gone. This is a way that I like to introduce gas laws. We're going to use a device to go through and do some experiments on gases. And we are going to compile some data, some relationships. So we're going to combine those relationships into what we then think of as the gas laws. And in order to do this, we are using a device that is a chamber. The chamber has a moving piston. The piston can go up and down, although there's a locking pin, so we can lock the piston in place if we want. The piston, when it moves up and down, changes the volume. We have a valve. We can let gas in and out of the valve as we so desire. We have a temperature thermometer that we can read the temperature on, and a pressure gauge that we can read the pressure on. And we are going to then look at two variables, either volume and temperature or volume and pressure, and we will keep the moles and the other things constant. And we'll try to develop these relationships by looking at keeping two things constant and exploring the relationship between two other things. Now, before we start and start going through that experiment and using that device, we need to first set some assumptions. And these assumptions are assumptions that we make about gases that we are going to call sort of an ideal gas. These ideal gas assumptions are not reality, but they're going to allow us to be able to develop some rules that help us to, a model basically, that help us to understand how a gas actually functions and how it works. So the first thing that we say is that gases move in straight lines. So gas particles, molecules, move in straight lines . Basically, by saying that, we're saying they're ideal. They are unaffected by gravity. So when we say that they move in straight lines, they're unaffected by gravity. And they change speed and direction through collisions. And in fact, this word is so important that every time I use this word, I'm going to highlight it out in red. Because gases are nothing more than a giant game of billiards. And if you think about gases like billiards, in the way that billiard balls, when they hit each other, they trade velocities and they trade directions. That's exactly what a gas is. It is a bunch of billiard balls slamming together that collide. And when they collide, they change directions and they change speed. And they can, just like billiards, collide with the walls and change direction and speed after colliding with a wall as well. So it's all about collisions with gases. That is the key word in gases. The other thing that we say about a gas is that the size of the gas molecule is not relevant.
Just to clarify for thought purposes, when we're saying gas, we're talking about like oxygen or carbon dioxide. Okay, cool.
Exactly.
Great.
Yeah, and the size of the molecule is not important. In fact, we think of these, think of a gas molecule as a point mass. A mass without size. It'll help. It's not reality, but for the assumptions that we're going to make, it means that all gases are pretty much the same. They just weigh different. Okay, next concept is that there are no attractive forces between gas particles. And those no attractive forces are important because the gas particles don't really stick to each other or don't deviate when they fly past each other. If they don't hit each other, then they just fly on past each other. And so we assume that there are no attractive forces between the gas molecules. And the last thing is that based on the kinetic molecular theory, which we have covered in the beginning of class, the speed of a particle is proportional to its temperature. So the hotter something is, the faster it's moving. And the last thing I suppose that we want to say is that when particles, gas particles, collide with a surface, collisions with walls, result in the transfer of force per unit area. Which equals pressure. That a force per unit area actually is pressure. And so the number of collisions and the force of collisions is proportional to pressure. So this symbol That symbol we're going to use means proportional to. Okay.
And that's an alpha symbol?
It's an alpha symbol. Exactly. We're using alpha as proportional to. So the gas particles, they move in straight lines, unaffected by gravity, change speed and direction through collisions. Size of molecule is not important. Question? Okay, think of a gas molecule as a point mass, a mass without volume. There are no attractive forces between the gas molecules. The kinetic molecular theory holds for gases the same as it does anything else, that the speed of a gas molecule is proportional to its temperature. Hotter equals faster. Collisions with walls result in the transfer of force per unit area, which equals pressure, and the number of collisions and the force of collisions is proportional to the pressure of a gas. And I think that I wanted to hit, again, it's all about the number of collisions. Collisions is the key word here. Okay. Just some ideas. A nitrogen gas and oxygen gas, they're about the same size. At 25 degrees Celsius, they're traveling at almost 500 miles per hour. That those gas particles are traveling extremely fast at 25 degrees Celsius. That on average, a gas particle can travel 10 times its diameter. So if we look at the diameter of a gas and we think about how big it is, it will travel about 10 times its diameter before it collides with something. Before it hits another particle and they bounce off. So that's just on average. Another idea is that when we look at a solid versus a liquid versus a gas, and we'll have to put a stopper in here in order to contain the gas. That the solid is about, I don't know, about 96% particles, maybe. We say somewhere between 95 is sort of an upper limit. Let's go with 90 to 95%. Particles. And that means that it's got like 5 to 10% empty space. Nothing. A liquid is somewhere around 85 to 90% particles. And that means that it is somewhere in the range of 10 to 15% empty space. A gas is 0.1% particles. And that means that it's 99.9% empty space. Think about what that actually means. These two we call condensed matter. A gas is not condensed matter. A gas, being in the gaseous state, we say is not condensed. And it's because it's so different in terms of its number of particles that a gas really is 99.9% empty space and only 0.1% particles, which means that the room in which you are sitting, when you look around the room, only 0.1% of that room, the volume, is actual physical particles. The rest of it is entirely empty. void, nothing, zip, nada, empty space. Which what? Is why we can walk through gases and move through gases, but we can't move through solids or liquids in a way. Question.
What is
empty space?
Empty space.
I always anticipate that question because that question always comes. What is empty space? The answer is nothing. It is empty. It is a vacuum. It is no particles, absence of particles. So when we think about what a particle is, I mean, you have to think about what an atom is too. It's a sort of a challenging concept that when we think about an atom, that atom, this is the electron cloud. And we have the nucleus that's sitting in here. And the nucleus has all the mass, but and the electron cloud has the volume. And that nucleus, we say, is about the size of a blueberry if we were to blow the entire atom up to the size of a football stadium, right? And so when we look at a solid and we're talking about a solid, those atoms are locked in space, sort of in fixed areas. And when we look at the amount of particle, how much of it is particle, we're saying the electron cloud and all. We're counting the electron cloud as well as the nucleus. And the empty space is what's in between. The empty space literally is empty. It is as if you were to think of a jar full of marbles and the space between the marbles. It literally is empty space like that. And so we say, well, what is that empty space? It is, it's just empty space. It's the vacuum of space. It is the universe, the fabric of which the universe is made and has no particles in it. And so that's kind of what it is. And so the solid, you know, in a solid, we say that empty space is like 5 to 10%. But in a gas, the particles are so distant that the empty space is 99.9%, which is why gases can be compressed and yet solids and liquids cannot. So we'll get to that too. So that's part of it. Okay, now that we understand a little bit about what a gas is, now we want to go back and we kind of want to start these experiments and we want to get these relationships together, because what happens is gases are made, or gases have, if we think about the different properties of gases, properties of gases are they occupy a volume. So they have volume. They have temperature. They have an amount of molecules. And in that, they're no different than any other matter, except they have one more variable, pressure. And for a gas, these four variables are all linked together. And because they're linked together, to develop the relationship of the four is complicated. So what we're going to do is to develop the relationship of the four, we are going to undertake an investigation using some thought experiments to try to develop the relationship of two of them in kind and then combine them all into one relationship. Now, this is a different approach than most textbooks take. So when you read the textbook, they're going to approach it in a slightly different way. And in fact, what the textbooks generally do is they generally go through different relationships called Boyle's law, Charles's law, Avogadro's law. There's a bunch of different laws. All these laws are the relationship of two items, either volume and temperature, or volume and pressure, or the amount of molecules and pressure. All of these things constitute different laws that are named after different scientists, not necessarily scientists who discovered them, but named after different scientists that worked in that area and were famous, and they named these laws after those individuals. That being said, I don't like the memorization part. I always try to get away from that. So I approach this from a different standpoint of, well, let's look at all these different individual experiments And let's see how we can combine them to gain an understanding that is an intuitive understanding of gases and how gases work. So to do that, we start with this guy. And the first experiment that we're going to do, I think, is one, it doesn't really matter where we start, but let's look at which one do I want to do first? Let's do temperature and no, hold on a second. Yeah, pressure and volume work. Let's do that. I was trying to think about which one I wanted to actually do first, but temperature and pressure. No, pressure and volume. Okay, got it. I'm good now. Pressure versus volume. And what we will do is we will hold temp and moles constant. So how do we do that? We get rid of this piston and this guy. We don't need that for right now. We get rid of this locking pin. We remove the pin. And that allows the piston to be able to move. We close the valve, and then we put a gas in here. Okay, with the gas in here, things that we are doing, we remove pin. We are going to then apply a downwards force on the piston that can move. And we're going to do this slowly to allow temp to be constant. Because if we do it too fast, the temperature can change, but we want the temperature to be constant. And so what we're going to do is we're going to apply a downwards force slowly. And then we're going to see what happens to the pressure. Also, we're going to keep this valve closed so that the number of moles can't change. So those are all the things that we're doing. Think of this like a bicycle pump and closing off the end of the bicycle pump and then pushing the piston down. And think about what's going to happen. You can probably predict at this point what's going to happen. Would anybody like to make a prediction about what's going to happen to the pressure?
It's going to go up.
It's going to go up. Okay. But the question, that's great that you are able to come up with that. That's what I want you to be able to do. I want to move this word without moving temperature. Let's see if I can do that. I can. But the question is, why is it going to go up?
Because it condenses.
Yes.
It's the same number of particles, but less room, so they're hitting each other more.
Because there's force being applied to the particles, which is pushing them closer together.
Ooh, I like all those answers. It's just not going to fit where I want it to fit.
But which one do you like the best?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's close. Shoot, I know what I need to do. I want these side by side. They need to be side by side or it doesn't work. So we'll just get rid of all of that. And I'm going to get these side by side if it kills me. I like all of them combined into a different statement. And as we draw the picture, we'll see what that statement is. Okay, now I can get this back in there. Perfect. It just fits, and I can get rid of my words that are over there. Okay, so now what's going to happen is the piston is going to move down, and I need to take my moles of gas and shrink them down. Okay, think about what's happening on a unit area of the wall. If I take a little snippet of the wall over here, and I say that this area I could define that area, I could say is a square meter if I wanted to, or a square inch, however I want to define it. It has a certain number of collisions per unit time as these particles bounce on and off of it. And the collisions per unit area equal pressure. So if the gas is diffuse and allowed to extend in a bigger volume, then I have a few collisions. With the wall, with, let's say, that area. Now, if I look at the same amount of area, there are more particles. And the more particles mean that I'm getting more collisions per time and per area. There are more collisions. The more collisions there are, the higher the pressure. So what happens is there are more particles per unit volume.
As the molecules hit each other more frequently, does that increase the temperature because of energy exchange?
Not exactly. The number of collisions of the particles does not increase the temperature. It is the speed of the particles that will increase the temperature, or the speed of the particles will increase with temperature, and so will the strength of the collisions. So it's not the number of collisions that increases the temperature, but the strength of the collisions and the speed of the particles which increase the temperature. Actually, which is the temperature. That's what temperature is the speed of the particle itself. So temperature is not collisions, but speed. So if I have more particles per unit volume, then I have more collisions per unit area. And that equals higher pressure. And so what we find is we find that the pressure increases while the temperature remains the same. So what just happened here? Volume went down, but pressure went up. What we can do is we can define a relationship that we can say that when the volume went down, pressure went up. This is what's called an inverse relationship. And one way to set up an inverse relationship is to say that 1 over the volume is not equal to, but proportional to, the pressure. This is an inverse proportionality, or inversely proportional to.
Is that a 1 over the V?
It is a 1 over the V. So it is said that pressure and volume are inversely proportional to each other. So we use that symbol and we're going to keep track and we're going to come back each time we identify one of these, we're going to make a list and we're going to put them into a list. And we've got a couple more that we want to do. So let me go get the device again and we'll set up our next experiment. I don't think I need the piston. I think I just need the device. So let's look at temperature and pressure. And now we'll hold the volume and moles constant.
You said gas molecules are not affected by gravity?
That's right. Now, that's an approximation. It's not reality. So we use that as an approximation to define this model system that we're dealing with.
Yeah. Just because, and this is probably thinking about it incorrectly, but if I think about like throwing a tennis ball down a tube or something, like I feel like as it goes down the tube, it's going to like strike the walls faster and faster.
Yes.
As it goes down. But yes. That's probably because of gravity. And not necessarily, that doesn't apply to molecules in a tube.
Exactly. It does not until, well, that's an acceleration. And so if we are accelerating particles through a tube, then the particle would act like a ball going through the tube and there would be increase in friction, which would be the interaction of the molecules with the sidewalls of the tube, but the particle would have to be accelerating. So if the particle were just moving at a constant velocity, then we have a different picture. Okay, so we're going to do temperature question. What
moles, how are we using moles here?
We could, well, the number of moles is the number of particles that we place into the chamber. And we could increase the number of moles. And in fact, when we do the next one, after this one, we'll do moles. And we'll see what winds up happening. So moles means putting more molecules in or taking molecules out.
We're using moles to understand the number of molecules inside of this container.
Well, we count them in moles because there's so many.
Right. Yes, yeah. That's what I mean.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, this time what we're going to do is we're going to hold volume and moles constant. So we lock the pin. And we lock the valve. And then what we're going to do is we're going to take and we're going to put a flame underneath it. And we're just going to kind of look and see what happens as we heat the whole system up. This experiment is akin to taking a closed vessel, some sort of can of some sort, and heating it. With a gas in it, and you just heat it up. So what happens as it gets hotter? Well, again, if we think about that area, and we think about these particles hitting that area, and how many collisions there are, the particles are moving slowly and colliding with an initial velocity. Let's say an initial frequency and velocity. And that makes my pressure initial. Then what I do is I heat up those particles. And as I heat up those particles now become hot. What does it mean to be hot versus cold? The difference is in the rate of speed of motion. And so when these particles were cold, they were moving slowly. They were moving at sort of one speed. And that speed allowed them to have collisions with a certain frequency and with a certain velocity. Now, when I take a look at that same unit area, the particles are moving much faster. And as they move faster, I'm getting many more collisions and much stronger collisions. So these particles are now going and zooming all over the place, but they're really moving fast. Whereas before, they were just kind of moving slowly. The consequence is particles are moving faster. They collide with the wall with more frequency. Per unit area. And collisions are more forceful. So what increase does that do to pressure? It increases the pressure. Exactly. So what we get is we get a big increase in pressure.
Maybe I spaced when you were talking about this, or but what is it about exactly about the heat that makes them move faster?
It is the kinetic molecular theory that velocity is temperature. The faster something is moving, the hotter it is. That is true for all particles across the board. It is part of our basic kinetic molecular theory that the faster something is moving, the hotter it is. The colder something is, the slower it's moving. So molecular motion is directly proportional to temperature. And so as something heats up, that heat is an increase in motion. That's really what heat is. Heat is nothing more than an increase in motion. And what you feel as heat is molecules striking your hand or your body or whatever it is with greater intensity and a greater number of collisions. And your sensors on your body feel that as heat. That's what the sensation is that we call heat.
Yeah, is it, so when you light a candle or a burner under the flask or the tube, is that heating the air underneath the tube?
Ooh, and, okay, now we're getting someplace.
Yeah, that's what I want to know.
How is heat transferred? You want to know how heat is transferred. Okay.
There's a couple ways, right?
No. Well.
Oh.
No. Energy can be transferred a couple of ways. Heat can only be transferred in one way. So conductivity? We can.
Something different.
No, sort of it is conductivity. Heat can be transferred through collisions. That's the only way that heat is really transferred. Energy can be transferred through radiation, through microwaves or absorption of visible light or different frequencies of light. They can cause molecular rotations, increased vibrations. All of those things lead to an increase in temperature for a molecule. But heat itself literally is collisions and is transferred through collisions. No collisions, no transfer of heat. So when you're asking, what you're trying to ask is, how is the heat actually transferred from this flame to the particles inside the container? Well, that happens through the container wall itself. If I think about the wall, let's do it as a wall like this. The wall is particles.
Oh, and it makes those particles move faster.
That's right. And those particles then collide. And in sequence, they're all colliding such that initially what winds up happening is these guys down here, as the flame heats these with the heat of the air molecules that are bumping into it, I get gaseous particles of CO2 and water, which are coming off this flame at high velocity and striking this surface. And as they strike this surface, they increase the heat of these initial ones.
Answer my question.
And then billiards, that heat propagates until it gets to this wall, and then a slow-moving particle of gas inside the container comes and hits this wall, and when it does, it's struck by a very fast-moving particle, and it jettisons off. Look at the excitement that you've generated here by this question. I'm just freaking out trying to explain this question. It then propagates that heat to the particle and transfers it to the particle.
So fire is... maybe fire is layman's term. I don't know. It is a combustion.
Yes.
And so it's combusting the CO2 and the H2O molecules which are released at a high velocity, which then transfer their velocity.
The CO2 and the H2O are the byproducts of the combustion. The combustion is actually the wax and the wick. It is the carbon and hydrogen in the wax and the carbon and hydrogen in the wick, which are being combusted to produce CO2 and H2O, which come off as gases. And it is those gases which then are striking with the air gases and creating hot gaseous materials that are then striking the surface. Okay, all of this leads to an excellent question. How does a thermos work? Why does a thermos work? What is a thermos?
By thermos, do you mean like a container for liquid that keeps
like a container for liquid, a thermos?
Insulation.
So
insulation.
And is it insulating because of the properties of the container? So
an actual thermos, a real thermos, the original thermos was a double-walled container. And inside the double wall, when you were a kid in the olden days, you had to be careful not to drop your thermos because the thermoses were literally made of glass. And inside the thermos was a vacuum. It didn't have insulation like styrofoam because we didn't have styrofoam. What we did is we created a thermos by making a vacuum. And it was two containers that were basically sealed together and they pumped all the air out. So what is a vacuum? A vacuum is empty space. So again, if we think about this thermos, here's the inside wall. Here's the outside wall and the thickness of the outside wall. I guess we could do the thickness of the inside wall and all the particles inside, right? So this is inside the thermos. This is outside the thermos. So you could put hot materials inside the thermos. And as you put hot materials inside the thermos, this inside wall gets hot and these particles start moving fast. But in order for the heat to transfer, what has to happen? A particle has to bridge the gap, a gas particle. And if there's no gas, there's no heat transfer, which means that the materials stay hot because they can't lose energy. Energy is lost through collisions. No collisions, no heat transfer.
So it's not that there's air in between the walls. It's just that there's literally nothing.
There's literally nothing, which means that heat can't be transferred. And when we put an insulation material in it, what we are doing is we are isolating air pockets that prevent the transfer of energy very easily. It slows down the transfer of energy because it slows down the movement of collisions through the insulating material. Think about a double pane window. How does a double pane window work? When you have a double pane window, and this is outside, and this is inside, why does a double pane window insulate? Why does heat not transfer when it's cold out here and hot in here, or the other way around? Why does heat not transfer? What is in a double paned window?
A vacuum.
Somewhat. They actually put a gas that has a very slow.
Argon?
Yeah, sometimes it's a noble gas generally that they put inside it that transfers energy very slowly, but they don't put a whole lot of pressure of argon. So it's not like there's a whole lot of gas in there. They just backfill it with a small amount of pressure of argon, which means that there's a small number of molecules, which means that it slows down the energy transfer. And so a double-paned window works the same way. It's the same principle as a thermos. If you can prevent gas from moving, you can prevent heat movement. You prevent conduction. And then that stops energy from moving through. So the transfer of heat is about collisions, and it literally is a giant game of pool. And the transfer of energy is through the transfer of collisions, which is really kind of cool to think about. Okay.
Something that I love is that this happens like in our bodies when we expel heat and it turns into sweat, so on and so forth. But I learned that in biology, and I appreciate the analogy, the pool analogy, because I can envision that both ways.
Yeah, it's a little bit easier to see. The sweating and the cooling, we will cover in our next chapter when we talk about the energy and energy of phase transitions, and we'll actually show why we cool down when we sweat. That's a really cool idea too, and it's called evaporative cooling, and it has to do with this whole idea of heat and populations of gases and the movement of molecules, and yeah, we're going to get into all of that too. We'll get a chance to talk about that as well. But we didn't finish out this example. I wanted to finish this really quick. We increased temp and we increased pressure. So both went up simultaneously. Temperature went up and pressure went up. And so they went up together. Pressure went up and temperature went up. And that means that these are directly proportional.
Can you say again why the pressure went up? I understand, but can you say it again?
It's particles are moving faster.
Yes.
They collide with the wall with more frequency per area.
Yes.
And collisions are more forceful.
Okay.
More collisions, more force, more pressure.
Yes. Thank you.
Yeah.
That's where pounds per square inch comes in, right?
That's right. Because it's one unit of measure of pressure.
Right. There's several, but it's like in an inch of sidewall, there's like 1 pound of pressure being applied by those molecules.
So atmospheric pressure, when we look at atmospheric pressure, the unit of pounds per square inch, LBS, pounds per square inch. So what that literally is that if we take a square inch, 1 inch by 1 inch, and we look at the number of pounds that are exerted on it, an elephant standing on 1 square inch exerts a pressure, if they put like 1 foot on down, a pressure of about 14 pounds per square inch. 14 pounds per square inch is the pressure that we feel at atmosphere. It's actually 14.7. It's almost 15 pounds per square inch. One atmosphere.
I don't feel like an elephant stepping on me right now.
You do not, but I guarantee you we have an atmosphere bar, which I usually bring out in class, which is really cool, equals 14.7 pounds per square inch. And that means that if you take a bar that is 1 inch by 1 inch, and this bar is made out of steel, and the bar weighs almost 15 pounds, or 14.7 pounds in this case, and this is 1 inch by 1 inch, that is what we call an atmosphere bar. And it is the amount of pressure that pushes on you at atmospheric at sea level all the time. It is the weight of all the gas molecules in a column sitting above you going all the way up to the atmosphere. It's how much all those gas molecules weigh. And they push on you 14.7 pounds per square inch, which is really kind of cool.
And this is not gravity. This is atmospheric pressure.
Well, that is gravity, but it is the gravity pulling on all those particles. And it is the combination of the mass of all those particles that we feel at sea level through the attractive force of gravity. So yes. All right. So we've got pressure is directly proportional to temperature.
I have a quick question.
Go for it.
When we measure that, is there, like, say we can't see whether we're increasing the pressure or increasing the temperature, but we're only measuring it. Is there a way to tell the difference whether it's the pressure or temperature increases?
They're connected. You cannot dissociate them because they are affecting each other.
Okay.
So the temperature affects the pressure and the pressure affects the temperature. If we do anything to lower the pressure, it will lower the temperature.
But there can be a lot of pressure without a high temperature, correct?
Ooh. In a closed system, they are absolutely connected. If you take different systems, we can create different systems where we have an open system and we increase the pressure, but we leave the system open so that the pressure can't accumulate. And then we close the system at some point. then the pressure and temperature are locked together. And anything that we do that affects one will affect the other. So you're looking at an open system versus a closed system.
Okay.
In a closed system, they are definitely linked together. And anything that we do to increase the temperature also increases the pressure.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
But not everything we do to increase pressure increases temperature, right?
Anything that you do to increase the pressure will also increase the temperature.
Except for in that first example that you showed us.
Ooh.
Because it's a closed system?
No. In the first example, I said that we did something very unique. We moved the piston very slowly. So if I slam that piston down, the temperature goes up right along with it because I increase
the
pressure.
Molecules are gained. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Because as the pressure increases, the temperature increases. But if I do it really slowly and I allow that temperature to bleed off through the outsides of the container, then I can look at the effect of the pressure versus the volume and keep the temperature constant. So what I need to do is I need to lower it at a rate that the temperature gets unaffected by allowing it to bleed off.
That was my other question, is if once it was compressed and we had succeeded in this experiment in the first example, if we shook it, would that increase temperature?
If you increase the amount of if you increase the amount of friction or other things that are going to increase heat within the system, then that will increase the pressure. But shaking it doesn't really work for a gas because a gas is so diffuse, only 0.1% particles, that it's not like a liquid or a solid where you can shake it and can affect it. So shaking a gas doesn't really do anything in that way. If you make the gas particles move faster, we accelerate them through wind or turbine or some other system, then yes, you can increase the amount of heat and it will spontaneously increase the amount of pressure in the system as well. All of those are excellent. Let me do just one more quick concept and then we'll go on break and then we'll put them all together after break. So the other concept that I want to do, I need to go back and grab the whole apparatus, is I want to do moles. And actually I have it drawn. There's no reason for me to keep drawing all of these. Let me just go grab it. Okay, pressure versus moles. In pressure versus moles, I'm going to keep the temperature and volume constant. So here what I'm going to do is I'm going to open the valve and I'm going to add gas to it. And as I add gas to it, I take what are slow moving molecules, but I'm going to add more of them. So I get more of them. What happens is when I look at that same unit of area, now there are many more particles, which means that I'm going to get more collisions and the number of collisions with that area are going to go up. The more the number of collisions goes up, the higher the pressure goes up. So what I get is pressure is directly proportional to the number of moles. And I'm going to use the variable N in order to simulate number of moles. So that I find that now three things are true. The three things that are true is that pressure is inversely proportional to volume. Pressure is directly proportional to temperature, and pressure is directly proportional to the number of moles, where this is moles. And if I take and combine those, then I can say that the pressure is directly proportional to the number of moles times the temperature over the volume. And that's what we've gotten out of this experiment, is that these four things are related in that the pressure is directly proportional to the number of moles, the temperature, and the volume. And when we come back after break, we'll try to get this proportionality out of here and try to figure out inequality, something that we can then calculate.
N is number of moles?
N is number of moles.
Is N for number and then we just put moles after it, or it
means number of moles? That's a good idea. N is really pulled from NA, which is Avogadro's number. And so this is the number of molecules in Avogadro's number, but N just stands for moles. So it's not really that these are equal, but that they come from the same thing. So this is moles. This is the number of atoms in a mole. So we just use the variable N. This is the first time that we've ever done this, using N for moles. Usually we just write moles, but in gas laws, it helps to have a variable for moles. And so we define N to be the number of moles. I think this is the first time that this has ever happened. All the babies are on the left-hand side of the screen. It's awesome. Okay, let's go take a break and we'll come back and we'll see how to get this into an equality, out of a proportionality and into an equality. Okay, 10 minute break. Back at 11:35.
but they never want to leave. But they never wanna leave.
just wants to dance. Get out the way and let the girl dance. Yeah, she just wants to dance. Yeah, she just wants to slide all over the floor. She wanna shovel her shoes and shake her hips. She wanna wave her hands in the air.
That looks like a good spot to come back in. Oops, that is not. Why do they make the Zoom icon and the Zillow icon look so much the same? There we go. Okay. I got to get those things far apart, so I quit clicking the wrong link. All right, so this whole idea of taking these three experiments that we've been looking at, pressure with volume, pressure with temperature, pressure with moles, and trying to combine them into one overall statement. And the way that we do that is that we take pressure and this new statement of moles times temperature divided by volume, and we graph them, and we put them in a graph. And what we do, is that we put pressure on the y-axis, and on the x-axis we put nt over v. So increasing nt over v and increasing pressure. And what we do is we then measure a system at many different points, and we create many different measurements for many different gases. And as we create those many different measurements, what we find is that we get a linear relationship between these two. And like I said, we can do this for many different gases and at many different points in a system. There we go. And what we find is that when we average all these out for all these different systems, it doesn't matter what gas we choose, and it doesn't matter how we measure it, that when we look at gas number one, gas number two, gas number three, and at different points in the system, that we get a straight line relationship between these two variables. And the straight line relationship follows a y equals mx plus b. In this case, because the intercept is at zero, it is just y equals mx, because b is equal to zero. And that means that what I'm getting is I'm getting P is equal to M times NT over V. And that slope, M, when we measure that slope, equals 0.0831. And it has units associated with it. I'll put them in as liters, atmospheres over moles, Kelvin for temperature, and that this we call the universal gas constant. And what it is a proportionality constant. And we give it a new name. Go ahead.
Sorry, sir. What is y equals mx plus b? What do those stand for?
A straight line, when we look at the formula for a straight line, y equals mx plus b. This is the slope and the y-intercept, just from algebra, just the slope of a line, y equals mx plus b. And when I have a line, such as what I've done here, that the equation for the line can be stated y equals mx plus b. And if I take that, maybe we could do it a little bit better than what I've done it. Maybe what we can say is that when we state a slope such as this, and the formula for a line which is y equals mx plus b. In this case, this intercept equals zero. The slope, this equals 0.08314 liter atmospheres over moles Kelvin. And the y, because this is the y-axis, so that when I look at the y-axis and the x-axis, and I take this, which is y, p is the y-axis, and the x-axis, and nt over v is the x-axis. So y equals mx plus b, becomes p equals m nt over v plus zero, because the b equals zero. And so this is my x variable and what I'm substituting in, and my y variable and what I'm substituting in. And so because that is zero for b, this reduces down to p equals m times nt over v. And that slope of 0.08314 liter atmospheres per mole Kelvin, we give it a new name. And looking to see, kind of like pi for circles a little bit. And look to see what other numbers go in there. Eric, yeah. So this value of 0.08314 liter atmospheres over moles Kelvin, we define as the universal gas constant. And give it the name, or the variable, R. And so we say that R equals 0.083. I'm having a moment here though. Give me 1 second. Yeah, I'm doing the wrong units. I knew I was doing the wrong units. We'll fix it. It's not 8314, it's 0.0821. The 8314, I always do that. 0.0821 liter atmospheres per mole Kelvin. Let me fix it up here too. Did I write it anyplace else? I did, I wrote it here. There's an 8.314, which is in joules per mole Kelvin rather than in liter atmospheres per mole Kelvin. And the 8.314 number always sticks in my head, and I should know better. 0.0821 liter atmospheres per mole Kelvin.
Is the 4 still a part of it?
No. Okay. It's actually, if we take that number and extend that number out, it's actually 0.08205. There's more digits. We round it off to 3 sig figs, and we use it at 3 sig figs.
But not 4.
Not 4.
Cool.
So that's R. So what the equation turns into is the equation then turns into this. the equation, which we call the universal gas law, starts off by writing it P is equal to R times NT over V, but we rearrange the equation and it's generally written PV equals NRT. And that's the form that we generally write it in, where, let's do it this way, let's do it underneath this. Where R equals 0.0821 liter atmospheres over moles Kelvin, N equals moles, P equals pressure in atmospheres, T equals temp.
Why couldn't N just be M? Because that makes more sense for moles.
It does, but they decided to go with N because of the way Avogadro's number is, because of where Avogadro's number comes from and the variable that was chosen to represent it. And they use N instead of M. That's just the way it is. I don't know the historical component of why N was chosen instead of M. This is volume in liters. So we have the units that are associated with this, liters for volume, atmospheres for pressure, moles for the number or amount of the substance, and Kelvin for the temperature. And the constant, the proportionality constant, has all four units. So this is the first time that we've seen this sort of proportionality constant that actually has four units associated with it. Now, before we go on and we start using PV equals NRT or showing how we can use PV equals NRT, then we need to look at units and understand units a little bit better. Temperature in Kelvin, we inherently understand. Liters, volume, and moles, we understand. It's pressure that we've never had to deal with before. And so the units of pressure are something that we need to look at. And then we can come back and we can look at units and see how we use this and do some example problems of how we actually go through and use PV equals NRT. So let's talk pressure units. We've already started to talk about pressure units, pounds per square inch. That sort of pressure, pounds per square inch, is oftentimes used in physics. We don't make use of it very much in chemistry, sometimes, but not very often. The pounds per square inch, we tend to, in chemistry, so I'm going to put chemistry units down here. We tend to use atmospheres. An atmosphere is abbreviated as ATM. And one atmosphere is equal to 14.7 pounds per square inch. There are other units that we use along with this. Millimeters of mercury, pascals, a bunch of different units that we wind up using. But the most common are atmosphere and something called millimeters of mercury and something called torr. And then up in the physics range, we have the Pascal. And trying to think what else we use up in there. The Pascal is equal to a Newton per square meter, is the way that a Pascal is defined. And in terms of, I don't know how many Pascals there are. One atmosphere equals 101,325 Pascals. So that's where the Pascal unit comes in. But we stick down here in chemistry. We stick with atmospheres, millimeters of mercury, and torr. And to understand millimeters of mercury, I like to explain, rather than just giving you the values, where millimeters of mercury comes from. Millimeters of mercury was a unit that was used for barometric pressure, for barometers. And the way that a barometer is made is it's made with mercury as a liquid. We take a pool of mercury in a container, and we take a tube, and we invert the tube into the pool of mercury. The tube was filled with mercury, and the mercury that was in the tube falls and creates a vacuum up here. And this has mercury liquid.
It falls because it's heavy?
Yeah, just because of its great density. And so this mercury, as it's sitting inside here, which is a silver metallic, very beautiful looking material, fills this tube. And what we do is we measure the height from here to here, and we measure it in millimeters. And that height is what is called the barometric pressure. That height changes as the atmospheric pressure changes. So if we think about what's pushing on this pool of liquid, this is the atmosphere pressure, which is pushing on it. And at sea level, at one atmosphere, it equals 760 millimeters of mercury. And so 760 millimeters of mercury equals one atmosphere. Now, when you look at the barometric pressure and they tell you what the barometric pressure is, they don't generally tell you what the units are. They say the mercury is reading 30.97 today, or the mercury is falling and is now at 28.64. They're saying mercury, and they're saying that it's rising or falling, but what are they actually measuring? It's obviously not 760 because at atmospheric pressure, they're right around 30. So what are they actually measuring? They're actually measuring, in the English system, inches of mercury. Which is another measurement. And we could convert 760 millimeters into inches. And if we do that, millimeters, so that's 76 centimeters, 76 centimeters times, or no, divided by 2.54 is 29.92. So one atmosphere is also equal to 29. We'll do it to 3 sig figs, 9 inches of mercury. And in the US, that's how we measure the atmospheric pressure, is in inches of mercury, which is interesting. But chemists don't use that. We use the millimeters of mercury. And there's one more unit. So we've got now millimeters of mercury, which is one atmosphere equals 760 millimeters of mercury. And then we have torr. Torr is defined as 1/760th of an atmosphere.
Jason, does that mean that an atmosphere is like one atmosphere, or there's the 14.7 pounds per square inch is equal to 760 millimeters of mercury?
Yes, 14.7 pounds per square inch is equal to 760 millimeters of mercury. That is absolutely correct. And so if the TOR was set up as being 1/760th of an atmosphere, that means that one atmosphere is equal to 760 TOR, which means that a millimeter of mercury and a TOR are identical, or we treat them as identical. I think if you carry out enough sig figs, they're not exactly identical, but they're very, very close. So to 3 sig figs, they're exact, which means that 1 millimeter of mercury is equal to 1 TOR. And so now we have all the pressure units. Now that we have all the pressure units, now we can start to see, how do we use PV equals NRT, and what can we do with PV equals NRT, and look at the types of problems that we would deal with in PV equals NRT. Let's look at example problems. A container holds 0.0362 moles of nitrogen gas. The container has a volume of, let's say, 100 milliliters. And we'll make that to 3 sig figs, so I'll put a decimal there. And a temperature of 25 degrees Celsius. What is the pressure in the container? With these, several similar to the C1V1 equals C2V2 problems, I'd just like to make a list. P, T, V, N, and you can even include R. And list out what each thing is. Pressure is my question mark. Temperature is 25 degrees Celsius. The volume equals 100 milliliters. The number of moles is 0.0362 moles. And we could put N2 if we want, but it's really irrelevant because it's just the number of moles. And R, 0.0821 liter atmospheres over moles Kelvin.
And that's just implied?
R is something that you need to memorize to be able to use. It's not that it's implied, it is always the same value. It's a constant and it always has that value.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Yeah. And the next thing, go ahead.
Can you tell me again what R is?
R is the proportionality constant that we are going to use to solve the problem. So it is just the constant that allows us to be able to equate P to temperature, volume, and the number of moles.
Which is that 0.0821 liters atmosphere over
mole. Yep.
Okay, cool.
Yep. Okay, so now what we do is we have to have the right units. The units are defined as liters, atmospheres, moles, and Kelvin. Anything in the anything not in the right units needs to be converted to the right units first. So we need to take and add 273.15 to get Kelvin to the temperature. So this becomes 298.15 Kelvin. We need to convert volume into liters for every 1,000 milliliters. We get 1 liter. So this is 0.100 liters. Moles is in the right units and we're okay there. Then we write the equation, PV equals nRT. Find the variable you want to solve for. Solve the equation for that variable, P equals nRT divided by V. Plug in the variables and solve the problem. Pressure equals 0.0362 moles times 0.0821 liter atmospheres over moles Kelvin times the temperature of 298.15 Kelvin divided by the volume of 0.100 liters. Watch your units. Moles cancels with the denominator. Kelvin cancels with the denominator. Liters cancels with the numerator. And you have one unit left, atmospheres, which is in the numerator. So we are going to get a pressure in atmospheres. We then throw it all into the calculator. 0.0362 times 0.0821 times 298.15 divided by 0.1 equals 8.86107763 atmospheres. And then we check sig figs.
You canceled within units on the numerator? Is that
the liters?
No. So you canceled from numerator to denominator, and then you had units within the numerator that you canceled?
Yes. Basically, okay. What I did is, yeah, I canceled moles with moles here.
I see.
Kelvin with Kelvin here.
Okay.
And liters with liters up here.
So you separated liters of atmosphere. Is that how you say that?
I canceled everything but atmospheres.
But liters and atmosphere is separate from each other?
Yes, they're different units.
Okay. But they're grouped together for that definition?
When I identified R, mm-hmm. and I did this piece here, R being the proportionality constant, if I think about how R fits in here, R needs to have units that cancel out these guys, mm-hmm. but leaves me with atmospheres when it's in this equation. Mm-hmm. So the way that the thing is constructed gives me units of liters times atmospheres and mole times Kelvin in the denominator.
Okay, thank you.
And that allows me to then cancel them out in the equation that I'm doing now. I've got 3 sig figs in my moles, 3 in my liters, 3 in my R. And while this value was to the ones place, if I think about the ones place being here and here, then this temperature has 3 sig figs. And so I round to 3 sig figs, and this equals 8.86 atmospheres.
Wait, can you elaborate on why temperature is not 2 and it's 3 instead?
Sure. Let's take and look at 25 plus 298.15. Wait, 273.15.
Oh, because it's an addition problem.
Right. Okay. And so it comes out to 298.15. Yeah. And so my sig fig is here, and I do my rounding to that position. So while I carried it out, I still know that it's 3 sig figs.
Got it. Because that has the greatest difference or whatever it is?
The greatest uncertainty.
The greatest uncertainty, yeah, is in the ones place.
Yes.
For your temperature?
Yes.
You have 25 degrees Celsius plus 273.15, what you're just talking about.
Yes.
Where is that 273.15 coming from?
That is the memorized conversion factor to convert degrees Celsius into Kelvin.
Okay, thank you.
Eric, what about bars? Yeah, we tend not to use bars. Bars get used more in physics than they do in chemistry. Generally, within chemistry, we're sticking between the three units of millimeters of mercury, torr, and atmospheres. That's pretty much everything that we use. All right. Let me show another problem. Let's do it this way. A can with a volume of 22.4 liters has 6.753 grams of nitrogen gas. At 24.6 degrees Celsius. What is the pressure in the can? This is pretty much the same type of problem. It's almost identical. Pressure, temperature, volume, number of moles, and R. As I go through and I list out each of the variables, pressure is going to be my unknown again. Temperature is 24.6 degrees Celsius. Volume is 22.4 liters. Number of moles, they didn't give me moles. They gave me 6.753 grams. So 6.753 grams, and this is of nitrogen gas, which is diatomic, N2. And R, 0.0821 liter atmospheres over moles Kelvin. Each one of these needs to have the right units associated with them. I will need to convert the degrees Celsius into Kelvin again, plus 273.15. And I'll get that value. And in fact, let's just do that. 24.6 plus 273.15. That's 297.75. Okay, we fixed that one. Liters appears to have the right units already. I don't need to do anything to that. But this grams, I'm going to need to fix. So how do I get this grams into moles? To go from grams to moles, I need the molar mass. I need to figure out what the molar mass of nitrogen is. And then once I know the molar mass of nitrogen, so we'll get that here. Molar mass of N2 is going to equal 2 times 14.01, which comes off the periodic table, the 14.01 grams per mole. And so that's 28.02 grams per mole for N2. I will then convert this by saying for every 28.02 grams of nitrogen, I get one mole of nitrogen. And we'll get that value. 6.753 divided by 28.02 That's 0.24. So it's almost a quarter of a mole. 0.241006423983. I'd let that run out. I'm going to use that whole thing in a minute, but that's my number of moles. So now that's done. My molar mass is sitting in there, being in my way. So that's done. This is already where it needs to be. Now I can solve the equation. And I can go in and I can say PV equals nRT. Solve for pressure. Pressure is equal to nRT over V. Now I can put in my variables. That n is equal to 0.241006 moles. I'm going to leave it in the calculator. I just don't want to write any more digits. R, 0.0821 liters atmospheres over moles Kelvin times 297.75 Kelvin divided by a volume, which is 22.4 liters. So I take that number that I had before for moles and I multiply by 0.0821, multiply by 297.75 and divide by 22.4. I come out with a value which is 0.26301198171 atmospheres of nitrogen, and then I need to do my sig figs. So going back into my sig figs and tracking, I was out to the tenths place. I'll be to the tenths place. That'll be 4. I was out at 4 here. That means that I know this number to 4. 3 for my value, 3 for that value. So I'm at 3. This equals 0.263 atmospheres of N2. There's the whole problem.
And just one quick clarification, the N2 is the nitrogen in its elemental state.
Right, you got it.
Sweet, thank you.
Okay, so these problems don't get any more difficult, really. I mean, this is the extent to which we typically do. It's just unit conversions. Sometimes we give you units which are in millimeters of mercury instead of the pressure, and or we'll give you pressure in atmospheres, and you just go through, convert each of the units to match with R, solve for the unknown variable, plug in, and then calculate sig figs. And those are all the gas law problems.
When you got 4 sig figs for these two figures, the moles and the Kelvins, how did you just cut it off at 4?
When I did this piece, I had 4 sig figs in the value that I initially started with, 4 in my molar mass. That means that I am going to round this to 4, but I'll use it in its extended form, knowing that it's only good to 4 when I actually go through and do my calculations at the end, because I would have rounded that number, but I didn't want to create a premature round off error. So I left that number run long in the calculator, and I just marked down that it was going to be good only to 4 sig figs based on the numbers that I knew went into that value and where I would have rounded that value.
So you use it in its entirety, but when you're counting significant figures for the answer, you consider it as 4.
You got it. Spot on.
Would you recommend when we do this initial conversion that we make a note of it or something, or just try and keep track in your head, or how?
No, I like to make a note, just like I was doing here. You can make a note at the time that you're doing it. I tend to go back after I do the calculation and I analyze my sig figs in each piece, and then I note it down as I'm doing it. But you could certainly keep track while you're doing it so you don't have to go back and do it later. It's a great suggestion.
So that N to the 28 comes from the N happening twice, right?
That's right. It comes from the molar mass of nitrogen being 14.01 grams per mole on the periodic table.
Okay, and then when you turn the Celsius, you're timesing it by what?
I'm adding 273.15.
What is that?
Remember the temperature conversions. The temperature conversions were from degrees Fahrenheit to degrees Celsius. What we did is we took degrees Fahrenheit and minus 32. And then we took and multiplied that by 180 under 100. And that gave us degrees Celsius. That was that 5/9. So that's 5/9. Is what that number reduces down to. If I wanted to go from degrees Celsius to degrees Fahrenheit, then I take the degrees Celsius and multiply by 9/5, 180 over 100. And then from that, I add 32. And that will equal degrees Fahrenheit. For Kelvin, if I want to go from degrees Celsius to Kelvin, the difference was on the scales of a 0 point, that in degrees Celsius, boiling point is 100 degrees Celsius and freezing point is 0. But on Kelvin, this is 373.15 and 273.15 on the Kelvin scale. And so to go from degrees Celsius to Kelvin, I simply add 273.15 to go to Kelvin.
I see what you're doing there. You're just converting them.
Yeah, exactly. I'm just converting them. That's all I'm doing in these, is I'm converting these. All of these are just conversions of units. Spot on. Okay, so we've had a couple of examples. When we come back tomorrow, we'll do a little bit more of gases. There's two more things that we like to do with gases. I like to show you how we can get to, which is just kind of fun. Remember that I said that if we had gases and I have PV equals NRT, I can solve this for R. I can say that PV over NT equals R. And I can have this for an initial set of conditions. And because R is a constant, which means it never changes, it's the same no matter what conditions I measure. That means that if I measure different conditions, that this is also equal to R. Which means if they're both equal to R, aren't they both equal to each other? This is what's called the combined gas law, and it allows us to calculate changing conditions. What happens if we take a container that has a gas in it and we change the temperature or change the pressure? What happens to the other variables? That allows us to be able to go through and calculate all the other variables, which is kind of cool. So these are changing conditions, and it's called the combined gas law. We'll pick it up and we'll look at that tomorrow. And then we'll also look at something called Dalton's law of partial pressures tomorrow. We'll see how to combine all those things and do some fun things with those.
Could you just scroll up to the temperature conversions real quick, please?
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
So some more fun things coming with gas laws as we get into tomorrow. Yeah. So hang in there with me. No panicking. We're all getting through this. We're all going through together.
I have unrelated questions.
Oh, okay. Unrelated questions. Fire away.
Okay. So just to clarify, someone asked earlier, do we get multiple attempts on the final?
Yes, I think I'll give you two attempts on the final.
Cool. Are we going to continue to introduce new material until Thursday?
Pretty close.
Okay.
I'll try to cut it. I'll try to cut it to Wednesday, but we'll see what happens.
Okay. Are we doing any kind
Thank you.
Of are we doing any kind of like review day or anything like that?
I'm pretty much using the labs as review of everything as we're doing it and trying to give you as much practice and as much FaceTime with me as we can, where I'm not introducing new stuff, but trying to have time to go over it. Okay. So save those questions up and we'll continue to use lab in that way.
Okay, cool.
And as I open that up to remind everybody, everybody is invited to any of the lab sessions and you can attend as many or all of them or whatever you want to do, including people who are not enrolled in lab. You guys are welcome to attend those to help out with that too.
I didn't work in the afternoon. I would be there.
There's always office hours. And then, oh, and actually, Kerrigan, you had a bunch of questions that I need to email you back. And I apologize. Yes. I haven't gotten to those this morning yet.
Please.
Yes, I will.
And I guess I'll just bring one of those questions in right now. For the, so I did the first solubility thing.
Yes.
And that question is not as pressing as important, but you'll answer it later. But for the other one, it's rough, man.
It's rough. Which one?
The testing.
The testing?
Yeah, the test.
Oh, yes.
That thing.
Oh, yeah, that thing is rough. I know. I know that's rough.
So how am I supposed to turn this into you?
It's
rough. I don't even know what I'm doing. What do you want from me?
I wanted basically the answer, but then a piece of paper that just has your logic of how you eliminated things, what things were eliminated, and how you got down to a single thing. So from each test, what was it that was thrown out? What was kept? And then the final answer.
Okay. And how many of those do you want?
Just that one.
Just one? You only want one?
Yes.
Oh my God. I thought you wanted like four of them and I just couldn't.
No.
Couldn't. Okay.
No.
You just want
the
one.
And we were doing it all together and it was just the one.
I know. But even when we were doing it all together, it was.
I know. It was rough even then.
Really rough. But I know it's important to learn. And I want to learn it.
So I hear you.
Just one.
Just the one.
Cool. Thank you. That's it.
You're welcome.
Awesome.
All right. Anybody else have any questions? All right. If that's it, let's call it a day. And then I'll see you guys in the afternoon lab. And then I'll be online for office hours.
Bye.
All right. We'll see you guys in the afternoon.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.